Indeed, that program is tonight, as it is Tuesday. It's the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. The book is subtitled Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It's an extraordinary book. It's edited from Lean Logic by Sean Chamberlain. And for Tuesdays going back to September 11th, we've been airing it in chapter form and then having a post-chapter discussion with Peter Buffett. Earlier, Peter Buffett stopped by the radio station and we dialed up England to talk to Sean Chamberlain.
Hello.
Hello, Sean.
Hello, Sean.
Hey, both. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Very well.
That's good. Peter was...
First nice day of the slightly early spring, I would say.
Oh, yeah? Yes. Really?
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Well, I'm just back from Florida after a few days.
And I was a few minutes late because I forgot I got to get snow and ice off my car. How about that?
Because, yes, I came back from Florida to about 4 inches of fresh new snow.
Yep.
So, but it's coming. Right. It's totally coming.
Yes,
right?
It is.
Yeah.
It's going to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Believe. I'm the forerunner, and I'm telling you, I've come back from the edge. Yeah. Spring is on its way.
Excellent. That's awesome. So I think what we're going to do is we would like to... play your epilogue,
mm-hmm.
and then do an epilogue to your epilogue.
Excellent. I look forward to reading it.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to the epilogue now.
Mm-hmm.
Epilogue. Mourning the market. The great transformation has already happened. It was the revolution in politics, economics, and society that came with the market economy, and which hit its stride in Britain in the late 18th century. Most of human history had been bred, fed, and watered by another sort of economy, but the market has replaced, as far as possible, the social capital of reciprocal obligation, loyalties, authority structures, culture, and traditions, with exchange, price, and the impersonal principles of economics. Unfortunately, the critics of economics have had a tendency to discuss the whole structure as a tissue of misconceptions. It is a critique that fails. The strength of economics is its considerable, if far from complete, understanding of the flows and comparative advantages that underlie trade, jobs, capital, and incomes, and the logic of optimizing behavior, all backed by glittering accomplishments in mathematics. That makes it a powerful analytical instrument, so that just a few misconceptions, such as a failure to understand the informal economy or resource depletion, can have leverage. Like a baby monkey at the controls of a Ferrari, they can turn it into an instrument with extraordinarily destructive potential. If it were a tissue of errors, it would not be dangerous. It is its 90% brilliance which makes it so. Economics has therefore been seductive. The market economy is effective for sustaining social order. The distribution of goods, services, and other assets is facilitated by buying and selling, supporting a network of exchange to which everyone has access. It provides suppliers with the incentive to know their markets and respond to them. It is responsive rather than relying on top-down regulation, and it learns from experience, so it is effective and efficient. It supports a more egalitarian society than any other large-scale state has been capable of, and it saves a great deal of trouble. It has appealed to minds glad of a cognitive technology which enabled them to make decisions according to mathematical models and with little fear of contradiction. Douce commerce, sweet commerce, wrote Jacques Savary, an early management consultant, in a 1685 textbook for businessmen, makes for all the gentleness of life. The authorities themselves agreed. Commerce is the most innocent and legitimate way of acquiring wealth, observed an edict of the French government in 1669. It is the fertile source which brings abundance to the state and spreads it among its subjects. Indeed, the government's main task in a mature market economy is to keep it free of obstacles that might stop it growing. Like a bemused farmer would treat the enchanted goose, keep the foxes out so that it can go on magically laying its golden eggs. The market's achievements and answers sound authoritative and final. But what is truly most significant about them is how naive they are. If the flow of income fails, the powerfully bonding combination of money and self-interest will no longer be available on its present all-embracing scale, and perhaps not at all. And it must inevitably fail, as the market's taut competitiveness demands ever-increasing productivity and thus relies on the impossibility of perpetual growth. In the meantime, the reduction of a society and culture to dependence on mathematical abstraction has infantilized a grown-up civilization and is well on the way to destroying it. Civilizations self-destruct anyway, but it is reasonable to ask whether they have done so before with such enthusiasm and in obedience to such an acutely absurd superstition, all while claiming with such insistence that they were beyond being seduced by the irrational promises of religion. Every civilization has had its irrational but reassuring myth. Previous civilizations have used their culture to sing about it and tell stories about it. Ours has used its mathematics to prove it. Yet, when this relatively short-lived market society is gone, we will miss its essential simplicity, its price mechanism, its self-stabilizing properties, its impersonal exchange, the comforts it delivers to many and the freedoms it underwrites. Its failure will be destructive. And the end is in sight. During the early decades of the century, the market will lose its magic. It is the aim of lean logic to suggest some principles for repairing or replacing the atrophied social structures on which most human cultures were built, as the basis for a cohesive society that might survive the turbulent times to come. Editor's note. Surviving the Future consists of edited extracts selected from the late Dr. David Fleming's masterpiece, Lean Logic, a dictionary for the future and how to survive it. Surviving the Future was crafted as the perfect introduction, with a seamless transition to lean logic very much in mind for those who desire it. With less than a quarter of the content of the full dictionary, this audiobook can provide only a taster of the full power, scope, and breadth of Fleming's vision and life's work. There was the necessity of leaving out many of the interwoven treasures of that most unique dictionary, with particularly painful exclusions including Fleming's stimulating thoughts on defense for lean communities, nanotechnology, the commons, education, spirit, law and order, humility, energy prospects, local currencies, climate change, imagination, genetic modification, ecology, identity, metamorphosis, systems thinking, anarchism, and the importance of nations, among hundreds of other entries. Details of lean logic, as well as reviews, footage of David Fleming, and events listings are available at www.flemingpolicycentre.org.uk/leanlogic.
And with us on the phone right now is Sean Chamberlain, the editor who made that note.
And the voice of the editor that made that note.
Sitting listening to myself reading the book is a very, very strange experience.
Right. It's like looking in a mirror or something. Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, and I've said it a number of times since we started the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club, you did a fabulous job with the audiobook. It's not an easy thing to do, and you did a wonderful, wonderful job with it.
Thank you. It's an exhausting thing to do. It's quite an enjoyable thing, but
right.
Yeah, it's intense for sure.
Yeah. Now, we began this on Tuesday, September 11th.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, months and months ago, and largely have featured a chapter per week. Some of the chapters were long, so we would split them in two. But pretty much every Tuesday, except for a couple of holidays, we've been meeting to just be, for me, speaking for myself, enthralled by the information here and the presentation therein. Just, you know, just amazing stuff.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you, Sean.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I mean, it's been a labor of love, really, to bring this work to the world after David died without seeing it published. So it's really wonderful to have this new medium of the radio show to get it out there and, you know, really spread that message that he ended on, that you know, the change isn't optional. It's not that we're choosing between, you know, his vision of the future or where we are now. It's that serious change is hurtling towards us, and the question is how we prepare for it.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's what I'm struck by when I spend time on Facebook, only to take a temperature of our culture at large, of course, and then throw a few words out there to see what happens. Yeah. But there's so, I mean, there's certainly others like us that understand that idea and are doing their part. But there's so many that don't get the kind of overarching framing that really was put in that epilogue, and specifically around abstraction and what we've done to relationship. You know, it's so easy and so such a tendency, specifically in media, to focus on a person or a way of being, like socialism or capitalism, or a, you know, these various ways to sort of divide and conquer and say you're wrong, much again like the epilogue had said. As opposed to recognizing, first of all, the time scale. This is hundreds of years in the making, and we're at the end of something. And it's a struggle to get that across to people, that this is a larger issue we're talking about.
Yeah, and even on a bigger time scale, because I love that line, the great transformation has already happened.
Correct.
You know, it's not here's this great transformation we all need to do. It's not that David's had some brilliant new idea that we all need to follow along with. It's really about rediscovering the ways that human beings related to each other for hundreds of thousands of years before we were kind of ripped into isolation by this brief, very brief historical anomaly of market capitalism, which seems so real to us because it just happens to be what we today were born into. And so it's hard to escape from the sense that that's normal. But one of my favorite lines from the full dictionary lean logic is we know what we need to do. We need to build the sequel, to draw on inspiration which has lain dormant like the seed beneath the snow. And that for me is the story that allows us to tell meaningful stories with our lives in this time, which, you know, when you know, people talk about, you know, when is it going to happen, when is collapse going to come, and in fact, you know, it already has for probably most of the world.
Yep.
The science fiction writer William Gibson, I often quote, said, "The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed."
Exactly.
And so it's sort of quite an affluent, luxurious position to be able to stand around saying, "Oh, you know, when is this catastrophe going to come?" When it already has. So, for most of the world, I would say. And actually, when you look at the way that people are responding to that in other places in the world, they're responding in the kind of ways that David lays out. They're rediscovering a dependence on each other and on culture and on the informal economy rather than on the monetary economy, which has essentially left them before they left it. And hopefully some of us can have the good sense to leave it before it leaves us.
Yeah, exactly. That's also on another from another quotable person. Russell Brand said the same kind of thing. You know, Armageddon is already here for most people. And I think that's what not only we have to remember, but take deeply to heart in this work.
Yeah. And what I loved actually listening into your shows over recent weeks, I forget the name of the community, but you were talking about Blobfest in the town where the film The Blob was originally made.
Right, in Pennsylvania,
Right, and I love that because that's what David talks about in the Carnival chapter, which was a couple of months ago, I guess, for those listening along in the radio show. But he talks about, you know, the way to start this work, this rebuilding of community in the informal economy is to start with what he calls the conception, which gives the community its life. Start with a party.
You know,
that's how to get people talking to each other again.
Yep,
that's
exactly.
How to create a narrative that gives people a sense of belonging and identity.
Yeah,
and it's such a joyous process in response to such difficult times.
And I would say I've heard Peter say that, two dozen times in the past couple of years. Starts with a party.
Starts where you are. Yep.
Yeah. And, I was in Florida this past weekend, and the town that we were visiting in is sort of like a Woodstock hippie enclave on the Gulf of Mexico, Woodstock, New York, which is kind of a funky place. And they had baked into it every Saturday carnival. They had some live music for free in their town square, and they had a farmer's market, and it was just a part. And because the weather is so accommodating, they can do it year round. And I was struck by just how embedded it was in what they do there. It's just what they do. It's supported by the city of Dunedin, and just really remarkable to see it as an accepted way of life for the people who live there.
Yeah,
right. And it doesn't have to be based in theory. I got a wonderful note from a guy who lives in New Orleans who'd read Surviving the Future, and he said, wow, this is what we do here, but I didn't realize how important it was until I read that.
Yeah.
And it really gave him this sense of, you know, this really matters. It isn't just, you know, the most fun thing we can do with our times and, you know, a wonderful way to spend our time. It's also, you know, the foundation for the sequel.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, you know, the simplicity of capitalism, you know, is something that I think a lot of people really hold tightly onto, because it's a formula that they sort of can understand, right? Mm-hmm. You can understand that the myth here in the United States is that if you work hard enough, you can work your way up and you can get these things. I was standing on a pier in a marina in Florida over the weekend, and there was literally dozens and dozens of yachts, each, you know, worth $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, and people feel like if they work, they can get to that, you know?
Right.
And I was standing there next to a gentleman, and I had this conversation with him that, you know, this thing didn't exist 125 years ago. People didn't work in the farms and fields so that they could buy a yacht.
Right.
Right.
You know, this just wasn't what they did with their slack and with their downtime, right? But that, you know, that is a myth here, because the people at the top hardly work as hard as the people down below. And, and when people can understand that, oh, this is just the system that's been, it's not the system that was or will be, you see a little twinkle in an eye and a spark happen, and they start to consider what indeed is next. And over these months, as I've listened to Surviving the Future, I've felt heartened by the idea that there is a sequel.
Yeah,
and there has to be, because it's so mad, you know, to spend your whole life thinking, well, I don't have time to party with my neighbors because I've got to work really hard to earn my yacht. And then you finally, if you're extremely unusually lucky, get your yacht, and then you don't have any friends to party on the yacht with anyway. You spend your whole time earning the yacht.
Exactly. Yes. The pursuit of happiness. At what cost?
The problem with the rat race is, even if you win, you're still a rat.
Indeed. Yeah. And the social interaction is so important. I think, Peter, you posted an article. Is it this morning?
This morning.
On social media?
David Brooks wrote a piece today, which is the day we happen to be talking to you, but it can be found online. I forget the title of it, but it's all about everything's being re-knitted together through social interactions, and at the local level and at the small level. He's really been on a roll reminding people of where life begins and exists, and how to build relationship over transaction.
Right.
Yeah.
That's tremendous.
I shall absolutely dig that up.
Yeah.
It's in the New York Times, and it's called A Nation of Weavers. The social renaissance is happening from the ground up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I wonder whether he's read Surviving the Future.
Well, at some point I'm going to find out, because we seem to be crossing paths now, certainly in our framing of where the answers lie, and you know, where ultimately the love and the nurturing and relationships are. And I have a feeling as I get out on the road, I might bump into him somewhere. I will make sure he does. I also want to say that it provides Surviving the Future, and more specifically Lean Logic, is providing another service you probably hadn't thought of. And that is that my daughter really was taken by it, as was my nephew when he was visiting. So we have a house, you know, of Surviving the Futures that we hand out But I sent her a copy of both. She lives in California, and she has found it a wonderful tool, Lean Logic specifically, to either thwart or attract suitors. Because when they're a little boring, she pulls it out and says, "Look at this," and they run the other way, or they respond. Right. So you've got there's another useful aspect to the book.
Yeah. Well, you talked before, didn't you? I forget the terminology, but you talked before about surviving the future being like those little magnetic things in tapes that check whether people are aligned.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The bias frequency. Exactly.
There you go. The bias frequency, yeah.
That's great.
So I can tell you with great certainty that my dear late friend David Fleming would be absolutely tickled.
I'll bet. I sure got a kick out of it.
That's great. Surviving the Future, this July will mark the third anniversary of its publication in the United States. It was before the election of Donald Trump. I'm wondering if you think in these past 3 years, if anything has, as an epilogue to the epilogue, if anything needs more of an addendum to the story, or if it still holds completely true as it is.
I mean, in some ways, it was bizarrely topical.
Yeah.
I mean, given that it was published sort of 6 years after David died, and probably 25 years after he did most of the work on it. I mean, there are some lines in Surviving the Future, like there's a part where he talks about how the art of logical reasoning has been in poor health of late, and so many people have commented to me that seems almost like a direct snarky comment on Donald Trump rather than something outdated. But in particular, I mean, I think the thing that I mean, one of the most striking things about the book is the incredible foresight of this man who, you know, just was able to see a sufficiently big picture that he could see where things were headed. And, you know, wrote about it so far in advance of it unfolding that in some ways it's maybe fortunate that it only became published a while after he died, because I'm not sure people would have been ready to hear it sort of. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago, I'm not sure it would have found its audience in the way that it has. But in particular, I think, you know, this sort of this creeping threat of a fascism, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever related term you tend to name it by. It's something that we're seeing in many places across the world, and I think, you know, while of globalization and neoliberalism are destroying our collective future environmentally and economically, but as we said, they've also sort of all but destroyed the present for many. And I think if you look at election results like Trump or like Brexit over here or Bolsonaro in Brazil, or indeed Jeremy Corbyn on the left over here being elected head of the opposition, or Bernie Sanders coming close to being elected head of the opposition in the US, I think the one common thread between all these disparate election results has been a desperate rejection of the establishment and the status quo.
Yeah.
Like the electorates all over the world, they may not grasp exactly what's wrong, but they grasp that something is really wrong.
Yeah.
And when people are looking around desperately for a new answer, fascism, unfortunately, has a really good track record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really important to remember that, you know, Mussolini, Hitler, they didn't only consolidate power on the basis of, you know, othering and fear. They also raised wages and they addressed unemployment and they improved working conditions. And if we're going to avoid the sort of drift in that direction, we desperately need this alternative kind of politico-economic vision that can restore identity and pride and economic well-being. And I think that's really what's at the core of Surviving the Future is. It's telling a beautiful story of how we can make the future better for the desperate rather than the fearful one, which unfortunately seems to be gaining a lot of traction in the world. And so, yeah, in many ways, I think not just Trump, but a lot of what's unfolding in our world today, in many ways, brings home for me how, you know, David's work lays out the most sort of realistic, grounded alternative I've seen to a future I don't have any particular desire to live through.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's as difficult as it is. I think it's been helpful that things are becoming more obvious, right. You know, in the form of Trump and Brexit and unrest in various ways throughout the world, really is. And social media in that regard, or the internet, has helped because people can broadcast their concerns, the oppressive nature of the situation they're in. And so it does bring up, unfortunately, it also creates incredible amounts of vitriol. So there's that. But that becomes obvious, too. And so we're seeing things in a way that we've never seen before. And I hope that accelerates the process, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting for those who've picked up the hard copy of Surviving the Future. Just after the epilogue, there's a couple of sort of appendices called survival tools, and the first one is called how to cheat in an argument, or even better, how to catch yourself doing it.
Right.
And that explains some of the sort of common fallacies in arguments that people make, which don't really stand up, but are incredibly widespread, and I think are a huge part of that vitriol that you talk about in in online debate, and indeed in, you know, presidential debates and all over the place. And it's written in, you know, David's usual sort of amusing tongue-in-cheek style. But I find that an incredibly useful resource for just seeing through the rubbish that comes out of people's mouths,
right.
And, like, diffusing some of the power of it so that you can focus on the actual thread of truth or real argument that's unfolding there. And, I mean, it genuinely is a useful tool for surviving the future, I think. So I'd recommend looking that up for either in Surviving the Future or Lean Logic itself, the full dictionary.
And there is a second in the appendix too, right? Another tool, which is titled Lean Thinking.
That's right. Yeah, which, you know, I mean, I think I think for all David's wonders, I'm not convinced he was especially good at titles.
You're right.
And his dictionary being called Lean Logic is, like a lot of his titles, I think it's one of those titles that once you've read the book, it's kind of insightful and amusing, but that doesn't really tell you very much about the book before you've read it.
Right. Go ahead.
But what this lean in the title is all about is this concept of lean thinking, which is something that actually developed in the automotive industry in Toyota in Japan. But essentially, the essence of it is that there's a real shortcoming in sort of top-down management systems in any context, which is that the people at the top making the decisions don't really have the in-depth understanding of the problems at the bottom. So, you know, in Toyota, the people working on the assembly line knew exactly what was wrong and knew exactly what needed to be changed to make their jobs easier and more efficient, but they weren't the ones empowered to make the decision. And as a consequence, they developed this management system which they called lean thinking, which is all about the people at the bottom being empowered to make their own decisions. And as in that little story that you may remember from way back when you read the introduction of Surviving the Future, you know, quite quickly the management find that they're a bit redundant and the people are quite capable of organizing themselves and getting things done.
Yep.
And so the reason it's called Lean Logic and the reason the second survival tool in Surviving the Future is lean thinking is because it's all about that. It's all about people at the local level getting together, discussing their local needs, their local abilities, their local resources, and just making decisions and getting on with it rather than, you know, lobbying politicians or whatever.
Yep.
And that, as you'll know, having listened through the whole book, is really at the core of David's thinking. It's that, you know, the solutions lie with ordinary people and communities, not with, you know, top-down expertise.
And if you went to the Novo Foundation website, you'd read the same thing. I mean, that is so core to what we've learned. And of course, what is obvious once you step back and you're not a bureaucrat or a top-down person yourself, you allow for that to be possible. And then you look around and go, oh, not only is it possible, it's happening. And we should be listening to the ground, which reminds me, you mentioned seeds before, and a native friend of mine, there's a famous line, or it's famous to me, that, you know, they tried to bury us, they didn't realize we were seeds. And
yeah.
And you know, that is goes beyond just the native community to anyone that feels voiceless or marginalized or, you know, not able to be lifted up in this time. So
right, I mean, I actually was talking to a friend yesterday that one of the things I take inspiration from basically is a literal seed. I was out walking in the forest one day and feeling a bit overwhelmed by just, you know, what's unfolding in the world, and I was thinking about climate change, now that seems to be running out of control. And I came across this tree, and in the side of the tree there was a little hollow, and some water and dirt had gathered in the hollow, and another tree had seeded down there and had put up a shoot. And I'm looking at this little sapling and thinking, what are you doing? Right. You can't grow there. Right. You know, you're not going to be a fully grown tree on the side of another tree. It doesn't make any sense. And it was just realizing that life doesn't sit there thinking, you know, what are my chances? Is it worth making the effort? You know, what's the point of it all? It just lives, you know, it just does what life does, and it grows, and it makes its contribution to the world, and it tells its story. And I just sort of thought, you know, it just felt like there was something quite indulgent about looking at the situation and thinking, oh, it's all hopeless and what's the point, you know? Right. Actually, the thing to do is to, yeah, is to tell your story and do it to the full extent. And we never really know the consequences, you know? Like, I had no idea that, you know, when I got this book published, that anyone would read it, or that there'd ever be an audio book or a radio show. Like, absolutely no conception that what we're doing now would ever exist. But I was totally clear that was the thing I needed to do with that part of my life. And that feeling of clarity somehow was encapsulated for me in that seed, exactly, which was just growing and doing its thing. And it's a moment in my life that I think back to really often. It brings me a lot of strength, definitely.
Yeah, that's such a critical thing to remember. It reminds me of the Sir Ken Robinson story of the classroom where the teacher asked the kids to draw a picture, and she's walking up and down the aisles to look at what's being done. And one young girl in the back is drawing something. She goes, "What's that?" And she says, "It's God." And the teacher says, "Well, nobody knows what God looks like." And she goes, "They will in a minute."
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's Sean Chamberlain. It's Peter Buffett. It is the wrapping up of the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. Sean edited the book from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic. And before we let you go, there's going to be a film, right, Sean?
There is a film.
There is a film.
So, you know, if you're out there and you're thinking, well, gosh, I want to start with a party, but I wouldn't know where to start in making a party happen, well, show this film. It's a great start.
Perfect.
It's another resource that's out there for people. The film, it's about David Fleming and Surviving the Future and his legacy and the various places around the world in which people are acting on it. And the film is called The Sequel, What Will Follow Our Troubled Civilization. If you want to read about it, you can go to bullfrogfilms.com, who are the distributors, and just search on The Sequel on bullfrogfilms.com. You can get a license from them to show the film locally. So there's also Sterling College in Vermont are running a program of courses and an online course that's about to launch around David's work as well. So again, if you feel like not quite sure I'm ready to kick off and get started on organizing things locally, then that's another way to access some resources and some allies to try and make sure you've got what you need and you feel ready to go. And then, of course, Lean Logic is the other resource that's out there is a sort of more of a reference book in a way, but whatever's on your mind, you can look it up in the dictionary for the future and how to survive it and find what you need. But we're really, really happy with how the film's turned out. I've been making it over the last 18 months or so. And it's a really nice, an alternative medium for getting into David's work and what it's all about.
Yep. And like you said, bring people together and watch it together.
Yeah. And there's a great trick, actually, if you're ever doing a film screening that we developed in the transition movement here in the UK, is don't just show the film. Get people into the room, sit them down in front of the screen, and then before you show the film, even if it's just for 2 minutes, just get people to turn to someone they don't know, their neighbor sitting next to them, and just talk about, like, what's brought you here? Like, why have you ended up in this room? Because everyone's got an answer to that. Yeah. Chat for a few minutes about that, and then when it feels like it's dying down, then show the film, and then after the film, you know, get them to talk to their neighbor again about, well, you know, did you get what you were looking for? Is there something else that you need? And just, you know, don't let a film be a sort of capitalist isolated consumption experience. Like, right. Make it into a communal experience just by getting people chatting to each other. And a few people will look at each other a bit shiftily and like, oh, I don't really like talking to people, maybe. But then you'll find when you're trying to shut them up and actually start the film, nobody wants to stop talking.
Right.
So, make sure it's a communal experience as well as a film about communal experiences.
Yeah. Well, I don't quote Timothy Leary often, but one of my my favorite quotes of his is "Find the others," and right. That's what we're talking about, is finding the others. And I'm certainly glad we found each other.
yeah, absolutely. In David's words, "Do nothing that matters without consulting a conversation."
Yeah,
that's outstanding. Yeah. And I have a feeling there's a screening in the near future here in Kingston.
Most definitely,
indeed. thank you for your generosity in sharing your time with us on the air, the times that you've participated in allowing us to air the audiobook chapter by chapter over these weeks, and to your publisher, Chelsea Green, for doing the same. Sean Chamberlain, we will see you down the road.
Absolutely. It's been a delight, guys. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.